Rebute Zucker. I don't even know what Java is. Did you?
Java, it's a...
Okay, wait. It must first see it. Now it sees it.
Oh, I see. You have a blue button. That's nice.
There you go, and now you can go on preview.
SKIM.
I see it right there.
Yeah,
I want to see.
Open recent.
Oh, yeah.
View presentation.
Oh, it is.
That's the one that I ran the other one from. All right, so good afternoon. Welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed your postprandial depression now. And if somebody falls asleep, I will make sure they wake up again. But it's obviously not the speaker. And we welcome Larissa Shapiro from ISC, who will talk to us about Bind 10. I find this in particular appropriate because a few meetings back, how many meetings back, 6-7 meetings back, we started a little bit of an initiative to support development of Bind 10 and some bigger ccTLDs, and I recall fondly the Germans and the Canadians apparently pitched in. So now we can hear a little bit about what's happening.
That button. There we go. Hi, I'm Larissa Shapiro. I'm the product manager at ISC, and I'm here to talk a little bit about Bind 10. I will make one brief caveat. I am the product manager. I'm not highly technical, so if you have questions that I can't answer, I will refer you to a colleague. Okay, you've seen this slide already, I think, from Eric, so I will give you the 30-second view. ISC is the Internet Systems Consortium. We are a nonprofit public benefit corporation. We do a lot of different things. Most people know that we do Bind. Bind 9 is very widely deployed today as name server, but we're doing a ground-up rewrite, which is Bind 10. We also offer ISC DHCP, which is a widely deployed open-source DHCP solution. We offer professional services that support our software. We have public benefit programs that include our HostedAt program, which hosts a lot of open source projects. Of course, FRoot, many people in this room are aware of. We do a lot of work with DNSSEC and IPv6 protocols. And my colleague Eric has been speaking here already about SIE and our security work. We're doing increasingly a lot of security work. And and I want to point out the little parrot guy on the right-hand side. That's our Bind 10 mascot, and we did a contest out on the internet, and then we had members of our steering committee and ourselves went through and selected some nominees, and then we had an election online, and this guy was selected, and his name is Bundy the parrot, and it was very important to our program manager that I point him out to you. It should be Bindy, maybe, but it's Bundy, which is a little disturbing. Anyway.
It's not Bundy, it's L.
L.
L Bundy.
Okay, I maybe don't need this slide in this room, because you guys pretty much will agree with me that DNS is important. But at ISC, we think DNS is really important, because it's what everything uses to connect to everything on the internet, and because slow DNS really sucks. And because with IPv6 coming, you can't actually just type IP addresses anymore, although most people never really did that. And because insecure DNS increases ways for people to attack other internet systems. So the point of this is to say that we really need really good DNS, and that's where we're going with Bind 10. DNS has come a long way since the inception of Bind9. There really wasn't a lot of competition for Bind9 when it first came around, and Bind9 is more than 10 years old. It's very much a monolithic phenomenon, and it does still run. The domain name survey indicates that about 80% of the name servers in the world run Bind9, quite possibly including yours, statistically, although maybe not in this room, I don't know. Anyway, it's a good piece of software, but it's getting really crufty, and other implementations have brought us a lot of new ideas, and there are a lot of new concerns that DNS needs to respond to. I've listed a few of those here. Our colleagues who do NSDN Unbound are very effective at dealing with servers with small numbers of zones, and also I think the separation of the authoritative and recursive has been really influential. And then we've looked a lot at PowerDNS because people want to hook up SQL, and then you've got all your applications that include Bind that offer various management layers that we're quite interested in. This is all leading up to you know, where we're going with Bind10. And there's also a lot of needs in the DNS world that haven't really been filled yet, plus more that I didn't mention. So that's really where Bind10 comes in. Bind10 was, you know, the idea was conceived, as was mentioned earlier, several years ago, and certainly Paul Vixie and Joao Damas were very instrumental with some other folks in this room in coming up with the initial startup funds for Bind10. And it's a ground-up rewrite of Bind, and it's meant to be a solution for diverse DNS requirements. The project is now entering its third year. We're about to release the release for the end of the second year. And it's really a collaborative exercise with our sponsors in a way that is somewhat new for us. So here's the five-year plan for Bind10. In the first year, we did the initial architectural work as well as the first deployment of the authoritative server. And in the second year, which is just winding up, we've done a lot more work on the authoritative server, and we've also done the initial recursive server. And in year three, we're planning to become ready for production in both the authoritative and the recursive servers. But you'll notice that year four is what we call the drop-in Bind9 replacement. And what that really means operationally is that there's probably a lot of aspects that if you currently have Bind9 in your network, you should be able to run Bind10, but it's really a standalone thing right now. You can't just drop in and it won't necessarily have all the hooks by the time we get to the third year deliverables. So by the end of year four, we should be there. And then in year five, we'll get to what we call the really fun stuff, which basically means expanding the concept of what DNS includes, and we're going to do clustering support, and that's where we'll get into the plugin model and really trying to support people being able to make their own modules for Bind10. We're really hoping that will be a big movement in our community. All right, a few of the Bind10 architectural goals. Really key to the way Bind10 works is the modularity. So there's isolated processes, authoritative, recursive, statistics. There's a whole lot of daemons, and they talk to each other through the boss process. And well-defined APIs and libraries that are also well-documented, and this is part of making the product extensible. The full runtime control, the idea is that you should not have to restart. You shouldn't have all your configuration in namd.conf anymore unless you want to, or you need to. It should all be dynamically generatable and on the fly. And then we're completely redoing the command line language. It's meant to be flexible and intuitive, which just should mean that it is good and works well. And actually, we're working on a demonstration version of that to come out earlier in the next year, and we'd really like to get people to try it and give us feedback before we do the full implementation. So those of you who are interested in Bind10, that information should be coming to the dev list and the announce list when we get that demo ready, and we'd really like your feedback on that, because we'd like to make the command line tool that you want. Here's some more architectural goals. we're trying to really be customizable, but what we mean by out of the box is that it should be not so difficult. So you can do a really elaborate customization and get down to a really granular situation, but there should be quite a few sort of one-button options: authoritative only, recursive only, slave or master only, dynamic DNS on or off. And then we should have an agnostic way for you to use a variety of SQL backends. And then this is what I referred to before. We've got the goal that we can customize through code changes, that there will be an easy way for people to add modules and then hopefully share them in an open source marketplace and make them available. And that we really would like the APIs and everything to be sufficiently hackable that sysadmins can add their own modules with a minimum of pain. That's a real goal of ours. Some more architectural goals. So scalability, obviously, when Bind 8 came out, it was, you could call it a single core. The system supported single core, but it was just CPU, right? And then Bind 9, we support multiple cores, 4 or 6. Bind 10 will support, you know, the reality of modern hardware, you know, up to hundreds of cores and multiple machines clustered together. Robustness, this relates in many ways to the modular idea. The idea is that reducing serious software bugs, what I really think is important here is that in the modular system we can reduce fate sharing. We had an issue a while back where there was a packet of death that could come around that we realized in Bind 10 wouldn't occur because you don't have, there's not fate sharing, and so you would only knock over one module. And it's, I think, it's not like we could always be less impacted, but I think that the more that the modules can stand on their own, the stronger the system is. So, yeah, let's see. Okay, this is something that I'm really proud of about Bind 10. We've really made a shift inside ISC in terms of how we're developing in Bind 10. We've always been an open source company, and we're still a managed open source company, but we're really developing Bind 10 in the open. Almost all of our development conversation happens on the public developer list and is documented on the public track site. The addresses are there. Anyone can join the list, anyone can read the track site, and anyone can read the source code at any time. it's in a Git repository, which you can access through bind10.isc.org. And we do also have, if you're just looking to follow the project, there's also an announcement list. The developer list is somewhat high traffic. The guys really use it every day to discuss issues. The other thing that is really exciting about the way Bind 10 was working is that some of our sponsors have provided us with developers. And so we're working as a collaborative team. We've got the ISC core staff. That's our program manager, Shane Kerr, myself, our account manager, Norm Ritchie, and then our developers. And then we've got developers from JPRS. One of them is here today. We've got developers and now also testers from CNNIC. And we've got one developer from CZNIC. And this has been a really wonderful thing because we really appreciate the diverse opinions, and also we get a lot of input from the operational requirements of the organizations that are involved, and it's just been a really good experience. The other thing is we're working on more community engagement in the open source community. We've applied for the first time to be part of the Google Summer of Code project for Bind 10. So we're just trying to be as open and inclusive as possible while maintaining our usual adherence to our software principles and our quality principles. Okay, here's where we are status-wise. We are very nearly at the end of year 2. Technically, the Bind 10 years go by April 1st. The project was started on an April 1st, and so we go April 1st to April 1st. Yes. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Look, I'm not attending that meeting. Okay. we do Scrum now at ISC, so we have daily stand-up calls, and that was telling me about the Bind 9 one. Anyway, so the release will be next Tuesday, March 22nd. It will actually be doing it from Prague because the CZNIC organization is hosting a Bind 10 developer summit for us for the week before IETF. So we're actually setting everything up ahead, and then we'll flip the switch from Prague. And we're doing developmental releases every 6 weeks. In this last year, we've moved to a Scrum development model, and we're doing frequent releases, developmental releases, and we're really hoping that in this year we can increase the amount of early participation and feedback, beta testers, if you will, who can look at those releases ongoing and give us feedback. We realize that through the first 2 years things have been in a pretty experimental state, but we're moving along to the point where that may become more logical. So some of the features which are in the year two release, the biggies, the functioning authoritative server with Bind9-like in-memory database performance. That's actually a red-black tree implementation. And a functioning resolver. It's not a validating resolver. The authoritative side does DNSSEC now. The recursive side will be doing DNSSEC very soon. And we have an SQLite backend implementation as well. That was actually a year one thing, but we've taken some of the quirks out in year two. And then we've got a statistics gathering channel with command line access that's been contributed by our colleagues at JPRS. And then just in terms of moving forward, the year three goals, we actually have separated out the production-ready authoritative server is the goal for September of this year, 2011, and the production-ready validating resolver is the goal of the end of the third year, March 2012. And I've got the URLs there at the end again, just so you know where to go. Okay. This was my colleague Shane's idea. He said, I should explain Bind10 at this state as being like early Mozilla. So you know how you got the Mozilla browser in somewhere in the 90s. I'm forgetting what year now because I'm losing track. But in it sort of worked. But you could see it was going somewhere really fantastic, you know? And the thing with Bind10 is like that project, we're not intending it to be a single piece of software delivered by a company and then managed as a product. I say this as the product manager, but truly we mean it to be a community ecosystem phenomenon. We would like that so much to be a tool for the community of DNS users and you know cared for by ISC, but it's not ISC's, it's ours. And I mean ours, the people in this room. So the software is getting ready for the next stage where we really want early adopters to come on board and start testing, and we've got and really using the software. And we've got some folks already on board for that, and I'd really like to talk to anyone who's interested. We will be launching a formal test program over the next couple of months. That's critical for the next stage of the project. Okay, this is how you can support Bind10. We are a small and nonprofit company. We really do need new sponsors. Quite a few of our sponsors are here, and we can't thank you enough. Bind10 needs more sponsors, straight up, we really do. And we need money, but we also need other forms of sponsorship. We actually have one sponsor who, due to their organizational bylaws, doesn't give us money, but they give us an engineer. We gladly accept offers of staffing, testing, you know, put a box in your lab, whatever it is. Or give me your list of requirements. Tell me everything that bugs you about Bind9. I would love it. I love to hear that list. Sanity checks. I'm not kidding. And, you know, all of this stuff is essential to building the product that you need and you want. Okay. I really mean this one. Thank you to our sponsors, and many of you are here. I'm gonna just read it out. Our founding and patron sponsors, as well as our new sponsors, that's CIRA, JPRS, CNNIC, Affilius, AFNIC, DENIC, Nominet, RIPE, Co.ZA, RegistroBR, CZNIC, and our newest sponsor is Google. We cannot fund this work without you. We are very honored to do it with you. So, okay, a couple of upcoming Bind10 opportunities to learn more. As I mentioned, March 22nd is the year two developmental release. On March 30th, actually, there's one more. If you're coming to IETF, there will be a Bind10 presentation and a more technical one at the IEPG that Shane and I will do. And then there's also going to be a buff, and this is actually one about Bind10, and we're also doing a ground-up rewrite of our DHCP. I know this isn't entirely a DHCP crowd, but some of you might be interested. It's going to use the same framework as Bind10. So if you deal with both in your network, it could be interesting, and we really need support for that. We're going to have a birds of a feather session at IETF to talk about that project. And then we're going to do a web seminar in April about the third year of Bind 10 and where we're going and soliciting feedback. So there's more information on the website. You can register for the webinar on the website. That's it. I'm open to questions. Yeah?
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
No, I'm abusing the privilege first, of course.
Hi, Larissa. Jay Daly from .nz. Jay. Have you any idea what type of custom modules people might be writing for Bind 10?
Yeah, I think one thing that people are interested in is storing other forms of operational data in the DNS. There's organizations store administrative data in their DNS. Also, there's been some discussion of different forms of reporting, monitoring, and reporting stuff. We're working on our own monitoring and reporting materials, but I think people are interested in that kind of thing as well. And truly, I don't know. I hope there will be things that I can't imagine coming out of that. We'll see.
You mentioned SQLite backend.
Yeah.
MySQL, PostgreSQL?
There will be both of those. It should be the... The list of what we're going to implement for sure, I think, includes those and Berkeley database. But the idea is that the back end should be agnostic enough that people can also apply other databases as they need to.
I'm asking specifically because Fred and Coca Tools do zone generation.
Right.
So if we can do this with SQL, that would be really cool.
Yes.
And I don't really want to have to write to an SQLite thing.
You would prefer Postgres?
No, I don't, but Coca runs on Postgres.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay, and Fred runs on Postgres. So a generic interface that you can plug MySQL or PostgreSQL in. And I think PowerDNS also runs on Postgres. So
yes.
If you want to replace PowerDNS, which is the obvious aim, as it is a competitor, you want to be as compatible as possible to make transition as painless as possible. Any other questions?
No. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, at least I, being a small CCDLD, I can lend moral support.
I appreciate that.
Okay, the next one is Steve Gibbard. He's now working for Nominum, and he's going to talk a little bit about DNS infrastructure.
Speak. Okay, you guys should be able to hear me now, I think. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about here is partly building network infrastructure to support critical DNS infrastructure like ccTLDs, and partly when to build your own infrastructure, when to use somebody else's. And got a little intimidated after sitting through all the great research talks yesterday, so I'm just going to stick a disclaimer on this right now and say there's no research here. You know, this is just purely a how-to talk aimed at the ccTLD crowd, rather more so than the OAuth crowd, I think. I am going to focus on network infrastructure here and not go too much into what happens on the server side, and that's just because this is my area, and I think a lot of you in this room can talk about the server stuff a lot better than I can. So DNS, as you all know, is critical infrastructure. Without the DNS, nothing else works. And authoritative DNS, or well, really any DNS, but authoritative DNS in this case, ought to be as reliable, you know, at least as reliable as the network that's hosting all the services that you want people to be able to get to. Because if your DNS is down, then having your network still be up gives you nothing. And as you all know, DNS is a hierarchy, and so you need not only the DNS servers for the thing you're trying to access to work, but everything in the hierarchy above it if you're going to be able to find it. So when you're thinking about how to plan this out, you know, you're operating a domain, you want to know where to put your servers, your reliability is going to be best close to the authoritative servers. You know, no matter how reliable the network gets, you know, it's still going to break occasionally, and the more stuff you have between your end users and the servers they're trying to access, the more likely it is they're not going to be able to reach that. Plus, when you get stuff closer to them, you end up with faster response times, and that's always good. So in the case of ccTLDs, they're location-based, and it's somewhat obvious where they should be reliable, assuming they're actually being used in the countries where they're intended to be used and not being sold as substitute gTLDs or something. So you want them to be usable in the countries where they're based. There may be other countries that do a lot of trade with those countries, or that, you know, are neighboring countries or something like that where they have to work. People outside may not care much. You know, if a country code TLD halfway around the world goes down, for the most part, if users in one place lose access to a ccTLD halfway around the world, probably most of them won't notice. So this is why, you know, it's useful to be conscious of where network partitions may happen. If there's a network partition, it's good if your local communications keep working. And there are a lot fewer satellite-connected regions of the world now than there were when I first started talking about this several years ago. There's been a lot of places that were previously satellite-connected that have been building fiber in. But if you are for places that are connected to the outside world by satellite, sometimes they'll see that satellite connectivity go down for brief periods several times a day when something goes wrong. And so, you know, if you're in a place like that and you're relying on outside infrastructure, that can get really annoying. If you have a region that's connected by fiber, then outages get a lot rarer because the fiber is a lot more reliable. But if it's a single fiber coming into the region, then and that breaks, then the outage may last a lot longer than it would for a satellite connection to go down and back up. And local phone calls tend to work without international connectivity. You can be somewhere in some poorly connected developing country and call across town, and it's pretty much going to work. But then you go try to make an international call, and it can be difficult. There are a lot of places, however, where even though you can make local phone calls across town, the moment you start relying on internet infrastructure, then anything going across town starts depending on the international links and becoming as unreliable as the international communications, and that's something worth avoiding. So notable incidents that are a few years old now, Sri Lanka, 2004, there was this fiber cut in the Colombo Harbor, and it got described as an outage of internet and long-distance phone service, implying the local phone service still worked and, you know, seems kind of embarrassing from the internet perspective. And in their case, they had their ccTLD hosted locally, but they didn't have a local root server, and it looks like they do now. So hopefully if that were to happen again, then at least some of their local connectivity would keep working. Burma, Myanmar in 2007, that was a governmental cutting off of connectivity, but apparently stuff kept working inside, and things in the .mm domain worked inside but not outside. I think that there was a lot of discussion recently about the situation in Egypt where the government cut them off and what infrastructure could have been built to keep Egypt's internal connectivity going in the face of that. And I guess a government shutoff is a little harder to plan for than something caused by a technical problem, because you don't know how far the government is going to go to cut stuff off. But, you know, this is another case where the more infrastructure you have locally, as well as perhaps, you know, externally out of reach, you know, can help survive that sort of thing if that's a goal. Root servers are now pretty well scattered around the world. I started talking about this stuff years ago, and there were some pretty vast areas of the world that the root servers were not covering well. And the root server operators have done a really good job of doing a wide build out since then. Well, if we look at this, there's still a bunch of Africa and parts of South America and a few other populated places that are pretty well that are still pretty dependent on root server infrastructure far away. So there's still some work to be done there. And if you're in one of these regions where there isn't good root server connectivity, then I think a lot of the root server operators out there would be happy to work with you on it. So now we go on to what do you want to build for your own ccTLD, and what are the goals? How do you build it? What should the topology look like? What sort of redundancy should you have? We covered a bit earlier on who are you trying to serve, and whether it is just your local users or whether you do have markets elsewhere that need good reliable access to your ccTLD. And then something else to consider is, how is your region connected? Are you, everything going through a central exchange point, in which case you've got an easy location in which to put servers to serve all your local users? Or do you have a bunch of different ISPs with different connectivities off to other parts of the world and very little local connectivity, in which case you may need to go put something in each ISP or go find something, some common point upstream where you can put infrastructure that they can all reach. And then whose infrastructure do you use? You can build your own, and I'm going to later in this go into some technical stuff about how you would go about building your own infrastructure. But you may not need to do that. There's a lot of infrastructure already operating for the benefit of ccTLD operators and others, so ISC, PCH, and RIPE, and a few others provide that for free, and then there's several commercial Anycast operators, including Nominum, who I work for. And then there are a zillion free unicast options out there. If you look at the current list of servers that are doing authoritative DNS service for country code top-level domains, it's about 600 and something of them, and a lot of those are various universities or people like Randy Bush and things like that, who are just have some servers that they're operating a few of those on. So if you want to get a good comprehensive infrastructure with some redundancy, so that if you lose one of your DNS providers, everything else will keep working and cover both good global coverage and the areas that are useful to you, you can mix a bunch of these other sources together and get a pretty good large-scale global build without having to go deploy too much of your own. You may find that none of the easy outsourcing options cover the areas that are most important to you. So you may still need to build some of your own infrastructure to fill in that gap, and then use somebody else's global footprint. So there's a bunch of ways to do this depending on what your needs are, but generally you don't have to do a whole bunch of your own infrastructure to make this work. But what if you are going to build your own infrastructure? Where do you put your servers? Ideally, you'd have some central location, like an exchange point, that all the ISPs are really well connected to, and you can stick stuff there and have it be able to reach everybody. And some places are better provisioned for that than others. As an alternative, you may have a bunch of different competing ISPs, put a server in each ISP, then each ISP's users can get to something local, and you can deal with replication, and that's something where performance isn't terribly, terribly important. If you're somewhere like Latin America, where there's relatively little internal connectivity compared to the amount of connectivity that goes up to Miami, then putting stuff in Miami, where everybody can get to it reasonably quickly, has some advantages. And then there's a question of, how do you serve the rest of the world? And partly you're going to want to serve the rest of the world because people outside may want to still get to your local content. And partly, if you put servers of your own elsewhere in the world, especially if you're doing things in an Anycast setup, then perhaps you can sync some DOS traffic directed at your servers somewhere where you have more capacity and where it's going to have less of an impact on your core users. So if you have, say, a very limited bandwidth international link connecting your core region with the rest of the world, there may be something to be said for doing a two-location anycast, one in your region and one at the other end of your international link, just to soak up that outside traffic. So there's an issue of, do you do unicast or anycast services? Anycast services are a bunch of DNS servers or a bunch of servers of any sort, really, with the same IP address scattered around in a bunch of places. A unicast service is, you know, a single server with a single IP address, or a, you know, bunch of servers behind a load balancer with a single IP address in one location. And this is mostly an issue of scale. If you're doing two or three servers or something like that, you want users to be able to hit a couple of different IP addresses in case there's a routing problem with one of those IP addresses. So you want each of those globally visible. If you're doing 60 or 70 servers or something like that, then, well, you can only get 13 NS records into your zone, and that's going to be a problem. So at that point, you need to do anycast. You need to overlay them in order to make them all usable. So even if you are doing anycast, having several different service addresses in different places is good for reliability. Let's say you have two anycast clouds with different IP addresses, and then you bind both of those IP addresses to the same server somewhere, and that server develops a problem where it's still announcing its routes, but it's not responding to queries that come in. And in that case, you know, anybody hitting that IP address is going to see that it's down. They're going to fail over to the other IP address. They're going to see that that's down too. So if you have multiple IP addresses being used for your DNS servers, it's good to distribute those in different anycast sets. So you'll have one set of servers that has one IP address and another set of servers somewhere else with another IP address. Unicast configuration, in contrast, is pretty trivial. You take a server and you plug it into a network, and it will work. And at that point, you just have to make sure you have enough capacity and that you don't have all of your different unicast servers sitting in the same place where they'll all be taken out by the same network incident. So let's say you are going to build an anycast network. There are a few things to keep in mind as far as keeping your traffic local. Backbone and making the anycast topology make some sense. Backbone engineers are often really good at keeping traffic local. You don't too often anymore see trace routes where you're trying to get from, say, San Francisco to San Jose, and it goes through Virginia on the way there, which 15 years ago was actually pretty common. We still see, though, that anycast DNS operators are often not so good at this and do end up in a situation where you've got a bunch of servers very close to where the queries are coming from, and yet the queries all get routed off to somewhere completely different. And that usually happens because people start plugging servers into, you know, they have, say, their San Francisco node and their Virginia node and their London node, and they plug each of them into a different network, hoping to get some network diversity out of it, and end up running into local preference issues where network backbones usually prefer to send traffic to their customers rather than to a peer, even if the peer is closer. So you end up with stuff going off in the wrong direction. So sorry to pick on VeriSign here, but there are four local JRoot servers in the Bay Area, according to www.rootservers.org. And I just a couple days ago was trying to hit those local servers from four different network points I had access to in the Bay Area, one of which actually in this room. And I wasn't able to get to them. My home connection has upstream connectivity from level 3, and my traffic to JRoot ended up on level 3's network and then ended up in Seoul. From my office, we have upstream connectivity from Global Crossing, and our traffic to JRoot gets onto Global Crossing's network and ends up in Mumbai. I have a server co-located with PCH, which has peering with Asia Netcom, and I ended up in Taipei. And then just from this room, I had, you know, the closest luck I had in any of this testing. This meeting appears to be connected via NTT, and that ended up in Seattle. So I assume, you know, this has been that way for enough years that I assume VeriSign has some goal in mind with this. But it's, if you are trying to get, you know, nice fast answers, that's something to watch out for. So you can get around this. Anycast can keep traffic local. What you have to do is get consistent transit from global ISPs. So you put stuff in a bunch of different locations scattered around the world. You get the same set of transit providers everywhere, and then they'll do hot potato routing to you, handing it off at the closest point, and your traffic will stay local. You do want to be careful with this, that you don't just get your transit from one global ISP everywhere, because then if that network does have a problem, you will become unreachable. And if you've got enough locations, you may be able to say, okay, well, half our locations are going to get transit from one, half are going to get it from another, and then we should be able to still provide reasonably close responses no matter which of those transit providers they hit. Sometimes you need to put a DNS server in a location where your global transit providers aren't available. And if you're doing peering with your Anycast system as well as getting transit, that can work pretty well. You just you peer in that location and hope that if your transit provider isn't available there, you won't have too many customers in that location who are using your transit provider. So if you peer with, you know, pretty much everybody in the region, you'll do reasonably well at keeping traffic local. You do need to be careful there as well, and that if you start peering with somebody in one region, you need to peer with that network in other regions as well. Several years ago, I was running the PCH Anycast DNS network, and we ran into an issue there where we had peering with, I think it was Telecom Italia in the U.S., but not Europe, which was, I believe, Telecom Italia's preferred way of doing things at that point because they were trying to protect their European market from outsiders. And we started looking at, you know, where our queries from various parts of the world were hitting our network. And we noticed that there was this big ring around the Mediterranean in which both North Africa and Southern Europe, where Telecom Italia was pretty much the dominant transit provider for just about everybody. And all of our traffic from basically every country in the, you know, in that ring, were all ending up at one of our locations, I think, in New York, which looked like a performance problem given that we had a bunch of locations much closer in Europe. And so we went back to Telecom Italia and said, oh, wait a minute, you know, this isn't quite working. You know, if we're going to peer with you anywhere, it needs to be everywhere. Look where your DNS traffic is going. Look what this is doing to your performance. And they fixed it, and traffic started working the way we expected it to be. So if you're going to do that, you know, be very careful that, you know, if you peer with somebody, you peer with them in all areas where you overlap. And don't take transit from non-global providers. You know, I found on the PCH network that fairly often we would install something somewhere and a bunch of local networks would come in and go, please, we want to be your transit provider. You know, look, we have this great connectivity to the rest of the world. And the moment you do that, you start seeing really suboptimal traffic flows, and that can be bad. We had one case where somebody in Perth in Western Australia decided they wanted to be our transit provider even after we said no and started announcing us out to the rest of the world via somebody who was a customer of a customer of a customer of Savvis's network in the U.S. And suddenly, you know, anything in the U.S. that hit Savvis was going to Western Australia, and performance was really bad. So always insist that your non-global providers who you're connecting to treat you like a peer, not a transit customer. So this is what it should look like. You have, you know, a bunch of cities scattered around. In this case, we have Hong Kong, San Jose, Ashburn, London, Sao Paulo, and Mumbai. And we have the same set of transit providers in Hong Kong, San Jose, Ashburn, and London who we're calling Transit A and Transit B in this example. Those transit providers probably don't exist in Sao Paulo and Mumbai, so we haven't gotten transit from them there. So our Mumbai node has peering with an Indian peer who, because they're Indian, all their traffic is from India, they're sending traffic to Mumbai. That works pretty well. Our Sao Paulo node has peering with a South American peer who also has connectivity up into into the eastern U.S., and they end up hitting us in Ashburn as well because we overlap in both locations. And again, so in this case, the South American peer will never end up sending traffic farther away than Ashburn and hopefully to Sao Paulo because hopefully they've got their metrics set up so that that's closer. The Indian peer should never have to send traffic further away from Mumbai, but those sites won't negatively impact the rest of the world. And if you do this, these are plots of connectivity, or plots of which countries' query sources ended up on which global servers from the PCH network from probably 4 or 5 years ago. And that shows that if you do this, there was a Palo Alto node that got most of its traffic from the US and Latin America and a little bit from Australia and Asia. There was an Ashburn node that got North and South America and some of Africa, and looks like it got Turkey for some reason. I forget what the story was in that case. And then a London node got most of Europe and a bunch of Africa. Hong Kong node got a bunch of Asia. You know, so basically the distribution that we were hoping for there. If you're going to do this, if you're going to do Anycast networking, you need to do some work with routing protocols. You're going to need to do your upstream peering with BGP in order to announce the routes. And you want to keep the routing very consistent, again, to keep traffic going into the right locations. So having a single global AS can help keep things consistent. You want to be careful about your BGP attributes. I saw a case fairly recently where there was a multi-vendor network with two different router vendors who were doing different things by default to the BGP meds, and because there wasn't a route map resetting one vendor to the other's defaults or anything like that, that was causing non-optimal behavior in the upstream providers. So be careful about BGP attributes. And then don't propagate the Anycast routes between sites. It's very tempting to go, you know, try to build this fully like a backbone and get, you know, OSPF running everywhere and announce your servers from one site into your OSPF, which then moves it over to your other sites, and then you end up with some problem in one site and it can just spread across your IGP and get and cause problems for your stuff in the rest of the world too. So the more separate you can keep things, the more you can isolate problems. Internally, you're also going to have to do some routing because you want a site to be able to drop the routes when the local servers go down. So you can use IBGP to connect to talk between your servers and your routers. You can use whatever your favorite IGP is, OSPF, ISIS, whatever. And you can, there are a couple of ways to originate the routes on servers. You can use Quagga or Bird as dynamic routing tools that you run right on the servers, and you can also use a load balancer that monitors whether the servers are available and injects routes as needed. If you're trying to pick a routing protocol to use internally for this, I think you'll find that OSPF has a lot wider support. There's a lot of load balancers, for instance, that do OSPF, but not much else. Once you start dealing with IGPs that are intended for routing straight to the outside, though, you lose a lot of filtering capability and a lot of control. So BGP can help out with that quite a bit. Most of the at least smaller Anycast DNS infrastructures I've seen have just used routing software on the servers to announce the routes out to the routers. You can also use dedicated load balancers in front of the servers, and those can monitor the server availability, do the routing protocol stuff, spread stuff among local servers. You don't really need those to do load balancing, because if you announce a bunch of routes that look identical into most routers, they'll just go round robin or hash-based load balancing or something between them, and will work perfectly well for load balancing. But the load balancers have other features that can be useful, like rate limiting connections from a source that tries to send you too much stuff or something like that. So those are sometimes useful. Again, if you're mixing load balancers and Quagga or something like that, be careful about your routing attributes, because it may be that they source the routes in entirely different ways and one of them looks invisible as long as any of the other ones up anywhere. So then, of course, anytime you're building infrastructure, you want redundancy. More servers are better than fewer, as long as you don't get so many that you can't manage them. As far as getting redundancy between your own DNS infrastructure and somebody else's who you're outsourcing to, there's no contradiction there. You know, just use both, and then you get the best of both worlds. You get your local control over the stuff that you really care about, and you get somebody else dealing with the stuff that's further away. If you've got, you do need to do a fair amount of monitoring, check your zone serial numbers on all your servers. If you're using Anycast, you probably want to monitor your individual unicast management addresses on those servers and make sure they're all getting up-to-date information rather than just whichever Anycast server your monitoring system has to see. And then also, you know, tell you if something's way off in your Anycast routing, it can be useful to check response times from a bunch of locations. And there are a bunch of commercial services like Pingdom, for instance, that will do monitoring from a bunch of places around the world and give you some information on that. If you're doing, being told time here, okay, I think I got two slides left or something. If you're setting up an Anycast network, there are some things you'll have to get set up. You need your servers running Quago or Bird if you're not doing, if you're not running load balancers. You need BGP-capable routers, obviously. You need IP transit from consistent providers in all the sites, co-location space everywhere you want to put them. And then the really sticky issue is, if you want Anycast routes that you can announce and withdraw in each location as your service becomes available or unavailable, you need a /24 of address space per site for this if you're using multiple transit providers. And that can be a little tricky to get, although at least in the Aran region, if you qualify as critical infrastructure, that gets easier. What should this look like when you're done? I've picked on Nepal's .np domain as this example for their set of name servers. So you can see they've got ISC, they've got APNIC, they've got PCH, and then they've got a bunch of local stuff, and RIPE, and then they've got a bunch of local stuff, too, to make sure that their local users are really well served. So some really old papers for further reading, and I think that's it.
Thank you very much. Lots of information to digest during a presentation, but of course we upload that things. One thing in developing countries, in Africa in particular, it doesn't matter whether you have got a system next to the other country. If I just checked, our local ISPs don't peer, so virtually all of them talk to South Africa before they talk to each other. All the routes go to South Africa. Sometimes, if there is a problem, it goes to Europe before it goes to.
Yeah.
There it makes more sense to put actually the F route in Joburg is actually closer for us than putting one in our own thing. But if we have one in our co-location, we can convince them to peer much easier, I would think. So, any questions? We're running a little bit behind the time. Good. Les Cottrell will from the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center will tell us something about Pinger.
Do I have a machine? Just go and load this on and I'll run it for you. Just say
okay.
Next slide.
Okay, I'm Les Cottrell. I'm from Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, so it's not too far away. It's my first ICANN meeting, so I'm a novice, so don't be too mean on me. I'm going to talk about network monitoring, so as Monty Python would say, it's something completely different, but I think you'll be interested anyway. So I'm going to talk about a very simple way of monitoring using ping, which exists on every machine that we pretty much have shipped these days, so it's pretty easy to do. But we've been doing it since 1995. So we've got a long history of showing what the internet has been looking like. The work has been done by been led by Slack, but it's also been done by other high-energy physics establishments, in particular Fermilab in Illinois, and then the International Center for Theoretical Physics in Trieste. The other group that we've been working with is in Pakistan, and they've been very helpful, and they're funded by the Higher Education Commission in Pakistan. Okay, so well, what I'm going to do first of all is kind of give you the mechanism by which we make the measurements, and then go on to show the results of the measurements seen over the years, and also then finally wind up with some case studies, which are kind of interesting. One of them is on Japan, which is kind of interesting today because of the earthquake. Another one is on Egypt and the Middle East after a cable cut in 2008. And then there's another one which I don't remember at the moment, but as soon as I see the screen, I will remember it. Okay, if we could go to... Oh, okay, so if you could advance to the next slide. So I will go over what we measure, the coverage, what we find, also relations to other things, in particular the Human Development Index, and then some case studies. So if we could go on to the next slide. So the way it's done is there is a monitoring host, which is shown by the laptop at the left, just to show that it doesn't have to be anything specific, which send 10 pings to a server somewhere in the world. The server then responds with the 10 pings coming back, assuming everything is working. Oh, excuse me. Assuming everything is working. Then the data is saved locally on the person making the measurement, on the machine making the measurements, and then they're uploaded daily to a repository. There's actually three copies of the repository, one in Pakistan, one at Stanford, and one in Fermilab. From this, we measure the round-trip time and the losses, and from that, we can get a lot of information. So if we could go to the next slide, I can give you an idea. So this shows you the coverage. It's a bit dark. I don't know if you can actually see it. We have actually 70 sites making measurements in 23 countries. There are four in Africa. It's been very hard to get sites in Africa. We also have what's called beacons, which means that every monitoring site is supposed to monitor the beacons. And then there's roughly 740 remote sites which are monitored. They don't need any software. They just have to respond to pings. 50 of them are in. We cover 50 of the African countries, and the countries that we measure to contain 99% of the world's population. So as I said, we measure RTT, and from that we can get jitter, we measure loss, we also measure unreachability, I'll come back to that in a minute, and then we can derive from these measurements the throughput, the mean opinion score, which is used for voice over IP and for other things like that, and the directness of the links. So next slide. So the simplest thing is to measure the round-trip time, so that the left-hand axis here shows you the round-trip time in milliseconds. And the bottom axis shows you various hosts in Pakistan. The light green shows you the average round-trip time, and the dark green shows the maximum round-trip time. I think that's right. So you can see that there can be big differences. Some hosts have very little difference between the two, and that shows that they're not very congested. Other hosts have very big differences, and that kind of gives you an idea of the congestion. One can also measure the jitter, which we do by measuring the inter-packet delay variation. So if we can go to the next slide. So this is the losses. The bottom axis show you the time, starting in 1998, coming through to 2010. The left-hand axis shows you the percentage loss. Now, losses are very good in the sense that they actually give you a good estimate, which does not depend typically upon the distance that you're measuring to, because typically the problems are at the end nodes, at the edges. So it's distance independent. As you can see, the left-hand axis is exponential, and you can see the lines, if you draw roughly straight lines as drawn on the graph. Obviously, there are a lot of wiggles in them, but if you put an average through them, it would be pretty straight. So what you're seeing is an exponential improvement, and roughly a factor of 100 in 12 years improvement in the losses. The best countries or best regions are almost obviously North America, East Asia, Europe, and Australasia, which are now seeing on average less than 0.1% packet losses measured by ping. The worst are greater than 1%, and they are Africa and Central Asia. So if we go to the next slide. So here's another measure. This one we can, if you send the 10 pings, you're sending 10 pings separated by 1 second. If none of them respond, we designate the host as being unreachable at that time interval. So we chose, in this case, we chose to make the measurements from a reliable host, which was at Slack, and we're measuring to Pakistan. Along the bottom axis, you can see the host, and along the left-hand axis, you can see the percentage unreachability. And you can see these enormous differences. Some of the hosts, which are to the right, have very large unreachability. They're just not available for large percentages of the time. If you look at the graphs to the bottom left, they are smoke ping type graphs, and you can see some of the hosts are just were not available at all. The black shows you we got no response. So what is happening there is that there are big problems of power in Pakistan. There's a lack of oil. There is some oil in the eastern province of Baluchistan. But in general, there's no oil to create the power itself, and their budgets are very low. So what happens is the universities have power outages, and they do not have UPS. And so this is what we see when we're monitoring them. Next slide. Okay, so we can also take the losses and the round-trip time, and then knowing that most of the traffic, certainly for the last 10 years or so, has been TCP Reno, and knowing how the congestion algorithm works in TCP Reno, we can derive a rough estimate of the throughput, which is roughly 8 times, 8 for number of bits in a byte, times 1460, the typical length of a large packet, divided by the round-trip time and the square root of the loss. Formula was derived by Mathis et al. So again, on the left-hand axis, you can see the derived throughput, and on the bottom axis, you can see the time starting in 1998. And what you see is that for Europe and Eastern Asia and Australasia, you've got very good throughput. That's the upper lines. Rather than showing all the wiggles, in this case, I've just fitted exponential fits to them. The left-hand axis, you'll notice, is a log scale. Australasia is catching up, and so is Eastern Asia catching up. If you look at Russia and America and then take the throughput today, which you'll see is roughly 1,000 kilobits a second or a megabit per second, they are roughly 5 to 6 years behind America and the Middle East. Southeast Asia is 9 years behind. And if you go to Africa, and then I extrapolate back, you'll see it goes back to 1992. So Africa is roughly 18 years behind where we are in the Western world. So if you think where you were in say 1992 using modems and things like that, that is a situation that you're seeing in Africa. Also, you'll notice that bottom line, which is orange and is marked towards the right, actually it's red, labeled Africa, is not only behind, its slope is less than the slope of the other line. So it's falling further and further behind, so that within 10 years, it will be 150 times worse than, say, to Europe. Next slide. Another thing we can derive is something known as the mean opinion score, which is where you sit somebody down and you let them talk to somebody else on the phone, and slowly you turn up the noise and the round-trip time and things like that. And they tell you an answer, oh, this is perfect, or this is awful, this is like talking on my cell phone to someone who isn't speaking the same language as me, or whatever. And they come up with numbers where 5 is perfect and 1 is just you can't connect, you can't hear anything. And again, you see here, this is the MOS score, 1 through 4.5 in this case. The 5 is obliterated in this case. And you'll see, going back to 1998, that actually most countries now, most regions now have pretty good connectivity. Let's see, which one's that? South Asia is not so great, although we regularly have Skype meetings with people in Pakistan, and they work reasonably well. But you'll see that Africa is still in very poor shape. Next slide. We've also looked at how does this all correlate with the social activity. And what we see here is, if you look at the blue box to the top left, on the left-hand edge, this was when there was a vacation. It was one of the religious holidays in Pakistan. So you can see the utilization was very, very variable. The left-hand axis shows you the round-trip time going from 300 milliseconds up to 700 milliseconds, very, very, very variable. But then when all the students went home and everybody went home for their holidays, the throughput, round trip time became much more stable. Then they came back again, and you can see various other things happening. Days when they went on strike, which is when it's very low. The strike is the second blue box to the left. You can see then when they all went on strike for various reasons that things got bad. So you can actually correlate what's going on. You know what to do if you want to fix the throughput. Just send the students home and don't do any work. Anyhow, next slide. So another thing we can look at is the directness of the connection. Well, you all know the speed of light in a fiber is roughly 2/3 the velocity of light in a vacuum. So if we take 300,000 kilometers per second as the velocity of light, then the round trip delay in kilometers we've given as being equal to alpha times the minimum round trip time times 100. So if we know the distance between the two hosts, then we can derive alpha from it. And in our case, we do know where the hosts are. So by measuring the round trip time, knowing the distance between the hosts, we can get an estimate of alpha. Large values of alpha approaching 1 mean that you have a very direct connection. Small values of alpha, typically 0.2 or maybe 0.3 or 0.4 or 0.5, mean the connection is kind of roundabout. So if we can go to the next slide, we can see again this is to Pakistan, and the direct links here, if you look at Karachi and Lahore, the ones in the middle, Karachi and Lahore, Karachi and Islamabad, and Karachi and Peshawar, they all have very large values of alpha. So they are directly connected to one another. The one on the right-hand side, which is Karachi, which is Islamabad to Quetta, if you look at the map at the bottom right, you'll see Islamabad towards the top, and Quetta is on the east side of Pakistan. And you would think that the traffic would go from Islamabad to Lahore and then across to Quetta. It turns out the map is incorrect. We were given the map, but actually the link from Quetta to Lahore has not been put in. Hence, the traffic goes all the way down to Karachi and then back up to Quetta, which explains why the alpha is very low in that case. So we can begin to get an idea of what the traffic actually does as opposed to what we've been told it was supposed to do. Next slide. Okay, so we can also look at how does our measurements, in particular in this case, the derived throughput, which is the bottom axis, which you can see is again a log scale, goes 100 kilobits per second, megabit per second, 10 megabits per second, plotted against the United Nations Human Development Index, which is a measurement of the length of people's life, their knowledge base, in particular what fraction of the population travel primary, tertiary, secondary education, and a decent standard of living as measured by the gross domestic product per capita. So you get a number from the UNDP, a Human Development Index, between 0 and 1. You also get another number for the throughput. And what we've done is done it for various countries. The size of the bubbles are the populations of the country. The colors of the bubbles are where that country is by region. And you can see that there is actually a clear correlation between the UNDP, Human Development Index, and the throughput, which kind of gives you an idea that one of two things going on. One is if you have a better Human Development Index, you're probably going to have a better internet, and vice versa. If you have a better internet, you're probably going to be better able to develop things and have a better standard of living. Next slide. So now focusing a little bit on Africa. The left-hand axis here of the bar chart to the left is the minimum round-trip time. In other words, we send 10 pings and we looked at the minimum of those 10 pings. The bottom axis are the various countries, which I've labeled, as you can see. And what you see, there's a big gap. Some of the countries, the dark blue, which are connected by geostationary satellites, are to the left, and they have very large round-trip times, above 450 milliseconds. The countries to the right are connected by terrestrial links and have round-trip times of typically less than 350 milliseconds. If you looked at Africa in the beginning of 2009, you see the map on the right. The red shows you the countries in Africa which at that time had links that went via, showed you the minimum round trip time of greater than 400 milliseconds is the dark red. And you can see that Central Africa and Eastern Africa at the time had very poor connectivity and almost certainly were running via satellite links. If we go to the next slide, you can see what happened. In 2008, there was one fiber went round Africa. It was the SAT-3 fiber. And it was very expensive. They priced the cost of connections based upon the prices to connect up via satellites, via geostationary satellite. It was a consortium, and there was very little competition. And then in 2010, the World Cup happened, and there was a scramble for a lot of people to put fiber through Africa, both down the east and west coast, from companies like Seacom, Teams, the East African East African whatever it is system subsea fiber system to put fiber down, and they succeeded. And so what we see now is, if we go to the next slide, so what we see is the impact here. As the sites were able to move their routing from the geostationary satellites to this terrestrial connections, what we saw was dramatically reduced round trip times, typically from 700 milliseconds, this is seen from the Slack, mind you, to 350 milliseconds, seen immediately. So what you see here at the bottom is a smoke ping graph. The background shows you the losses. Yellow means there's like 10% losses. Light blue means there's no losses. You can see that to the left, the round trip time is roughly 700 milliseconds. And then they dropped it to about 230 milliseconds. Then they had to back out a bit, and they've only one of the two directions was using the fiber links, and now they're pretty stable at 320 milliseconds. And not only that, the losses were reduced, and the throughputs went up because, as I mentioned earlier, the throughputs are inversely proportional to the round-trip times. Next slide. I'll skip through the next one fairly quickly. These show you other places. The top one shows you Zambia. You can see on August the 20th, it dropped. They had some problems, and they were actually had a lot more losses for a while. The next one down shows you Tanzania, a big drop. And then the final one there shows you Slack to Uganda. And bear in mind, Uganda is not on the coast. You have to come through Kenya first in order to get to Uganda. And not only have they got to Uganda, they've got to Rwanda, which needs to go through Kenya, Uganda, and then get to Rwanda. Next slide. Okay, so I'm going to go on to a little bit about some case studies. There was there were two big fiber cuts in the Mediterranean, one in December 2008 and one in January 2008. The graph at the bottom right is kind of a contour plot where the countries are labeled to the right, and along the bottom is the date, and the colors are supposed to show you what the throughput was like. Dark red colors show you good throughput. Blue is deep ocean, so to speak, is very poor throughput. And you can see that when the fiber cut happened, everybody suddenly drops into the ocean, so to speak, and you get this dark blue color. And it not only affected, say, Egypt, the cut, I believe, was off Egypt, it also affected many other countries as far apart as Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, as well, of course, as the Middle East. So if you look at the graph, I can't point to it. The graph on the left, you can see that actually the connectivity did not disappear entirely, but it actually went up from 200 to 400 milliseconds as there was much more contention because they were using backup links. If we go to the next slide. So then we had the recent internet shutdowns. This is the top graph here. Shows you Slack to the National Authority for Remote Sensing and Space Sciences, which is in Cairo. And you can see that at 11:30 p.m. on January the 20th, the last connectivity we could measure was on 11:30 p.m. January the 27th, and at midnight, 30 minutes later, it had gone away. And then it returned to service in 1 o'clock, February the 7th, of 2011. The one below shows you Libya. You can see that Libya dropped connectivity around 8 a.m. on February the 19th, and then came back again, and then on at 2100 hours on March the 9th, it's gone away since then. Next slide. Okay, so then we also measure Japan, which of course is very topical at the moment. We monitor 6 hosts in Japan. There's one at Riken, which is actually a research establishment just outside Tokyo. There's one at KEK, which is a high energy physics lab about 60 miles northeast of Tokyo at Tohoku. I've forgotten where it is. Anyhow, it's just northeast of Tokyo. And then there's another one at Osaka and another one at Okinawa. Unfortunately, we didn't have one at Tohoku or at Sendai. You can see the location of the earthquake itself by the red. So the hosts, what we saw was the average round tip time. Oh, first of all, none of the hosts went down. They all kept running. They're all accessible. But some of the hosts, you can see, took a large jump in a round trip time and then stayed at the new value. So we started to look at that data in more detail. If we go to the next slide. So in this case, we looked at a monitoring host within Japan. The first measurements were from Slack, so they were from the west coast of California. So then we looked from within Japan, from the research establishment at Riken. And it turned out that all the Japanese hosts had a constant RTT. None of them had this big step. So then we looked at the Riken host, which seen from California had taken a big step up in round trip time from other monitoring hosts around the world. And there was no effect seen from Africa, East Asia, Europe, Latin America, or the Middle East. But there was a big effect as seen from some sites in North America and from Canada, in the US and Canada. India, it was mixed. There was a node known as CDAC, which is one of the internet providers in Mumbai, saw no effect. Pune, another node, did see an effect going from 380 to 460 milliseconds. And VSNL in Mumbai saw a small increase. Sri Lanka saw no increase. And then where we have about 20 monitoring hosts in Pakistan, we really found out that it depended upon the internet service provider. If you were using the Pakistan Educational Research Network, then you would see the effect. But if you're using somebody else, you didn't see the effect. So then we went back to looking in the U.S., and what we found out was if the route went westbound from the U.S., or from Slack, to Sunnyvale, and then crossed over to Japan, then there was no effect. But if it went eastbound from Slack to ESNet, to the Avenue of Americas in New York, then there were big increases. So since reading all the blogs that have been going on, it appears that there have been some fiber disruptions in Japan, and I believe what must have happened is that the congestion as people move off the broken fibers has affected some of the links, but has by no means affected all of the links. Next slide. So that's it. The pinger measurement engine, by the way, was IPv6 back in 2003. The analysis, however, and the presentation stuff is not IPv6 capable yet. We have to get that fixed up. There's some references here, which you can go and look to in more detail. There's a Pinger Home site. There's an annual report. We put out a report out each year. And if you want to hear more about the case studies, there's a link down at the bottom. So that's it. Any questions or any thoughts?
Cool. You can just do this with ping.
Pardon? Just ping.
You can just do this with ping. Cool.
No, I'm saying I am living in Africa, and we're going to talk offline because you'll get a monitoring host with us too.
Yeah.
Stefan Bartsmeyer, Hafnik. How do you handle the case of hosts that stop accepting ICMP echo requests, or firewalls that suddenly stop to... because when you have long-term measurements during several years, hosts come and go, firewalls are modified, and ICMP echoes are very often blocked.
Yeah, that's a major problem. We have to keep on track of that. We keep records each day of hosts which are no longer responding and have not been responding for 60 days. If they're not responding for 60 days, then we typically try and choose web servers. And the reason we choose web servers is we know if port 80 is open. And so then we can actually see if port 80 is still open. And if ping is failing, we know they've blocked ICMP. In that case, we typically try and find, assuming that we don't have enough hosts in that region and that country to characterize the reason properly, we try and find another host in that region, in that country, which is responding to pings. So so the hosts do change over time. And that, as long as we have enough hosts, it doesn't become a problem. But of course, if there's only one host in the country and we have to change that host to another host, and that is in a very desolate region, for example, then we could get some strange effects which have nothing to do with internet performance. So we do have to be careful with those things. It's a good point.
Routing registries, Lutz von Hacke, the routing registries added a new field to the databases. It's called pingable. So you have an autonomous system, and it has an autonomous system object, and you have a field in it. It's called pingable. It's guaranteed to be not blocked and to respond to pings in order to find out if connectivity to this autonomous system is working. Do you feel that such testing facilities should be more more instructed or more pressured by policies like ICANN, that they say we do need a correct way to have to check that everything is okay? Should it be included in policies?
I think I got your question. I think you're saying that there's some nodes which guarantee that they will have pinger up, and whether or not they will respond to pings, correct me if I missed it, and whether or not this should become a policy that some hosts should continue to respond to pings. Is that what you said? Yeah. No, I'm 100% behind that. It would make our life a lot easier. But the reality is, I don't know whether that's ever going to happen. It's certainly extremely important, you know, for being able to find things. I think most people, when trying to troubleshoot a problem, they will probably use ping as their first line of approach. And when it fails, it can be very misleading, especially if you tell a novice user, why don't you try ping and see if it works? And they tell you, oh, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for nothing to do with the network, but to do with blocking pings. That is, it is very disturbing, but we've accepted that. By the way, if anybody wants to become a pinger node, we'd be delighted to have some more monitoring nodes.
All right. Thank you very much. I think an applause is deserved.
Thank you.
Okay, Jaap will tell us an update about NSD, and then we're about done.
Hi, I'm Jaap Akkerhuis, and I will try to be quick.
Nice.
And although I have 19 slides, and that they go quick.
That will mean that means Jay will be quick.
And
The point is, we don't have to vacate the premises on time because the meeting afterwards has been cancelled. It's just that I still want to go to the other side to listen to the other presentations, but we don't have a time constraint that we have to be out here by a certain deadline.
So, like everybody else, we're also thinking about doing a new version of NSD, the authoritative name server. And so what I want to do here is we first give an overview of what the general ideas are behind the NSD, then list the main features of the NSD versions, and then what we are going to do for NSD number 4, and we'll give a vaporware example. And first about the NSD versions. The first numbering goes from 1.2.3. 1 is completely rebuilt of the major number is complete. Normally, internals completely change in NSD. The second is a major upgrade, added features, stuff like that. And the minor number is for bug fixes and very minor changes. So that's basically the theory behind the version numbering. So that's what are the principal characteristics of NSD is that we are actually authoritative only. And basically geared towards root servers and TLDs. It all started because the root servers were slowly migrating to the same version of bind, and we were asked to create something from scratch, so to prevent the cross, that a single packet of that will bring down all the root servers at the same time. And one of the other characteristics is that there's just enough in documentation. We really expect users to be technical competent, and so we don't have to explain every little detail about how DNS works. And the other thing is because it really is keep it very simple, and we don't want any extra features just creeping in and bloating the code. We are firm believer in doing one job and doing that single job well. And we also didn't bother with other classes unless we had to. It's just the internet class because the rest is not used anyway. One of the main things we really wanted is resilience against high load. So we should really perform well under high loads without being crashing or deteriorating the performance that much. And if we do it slowly. Now the other one is it's completely built from scratch, completely independent code. So we introduce our own bugs and don't take the ones from other people. And so that's trying to keep in the hope we don't make the same bugs as other people. So the resilience against high loads we kind of did by having the answers pre-compiled, having it in core. Also, we assume that data is rather static, so the SON is not changing every 5 minutes. Remember, this was for the root servers, and that might not be true in future. But the TLDs has also more. I'm more for more static data than anything else. But they might add a lot, but the churn is not a lot. And we are very, one of the starting points was that we will sacrifice memory for speed. So we are memory hungry. And NSD0, that was the first one, just the server. The answers were pre-compiled in a database. The server doesn't know anything about DNS. It's just completely ignorant. And but as long as the pre-compiled stuff were was done, and the user interface was very Python. There was no configuration, period. You know, it works or it doesn't. And that was basically the idea. And there's some configuration with some, if you really wanted to do something with environment variable stuff like that. There was little to no XFI attempts for it. You know, if you really wanted to run it as a slave, cut the files from somewhere else, find another way to do it. And we basically supported the basic IFCs and the other two mentioned here. What you see is that, we actually expect a lot of clue from the user, and that's why the configuration, if people wanted to configure something, you really had to know what you were doing. Well, things changed with NSD 2.0. That is the first version which was started out to be DNSSEC ready, and it had to change the internal database, and also we couldn't compile that much in advance because of the sorting, the generation of MSEC. So the server had to know something about DNS, and so it's less ignorant about the DNS protocol itself. And we actually built, now delivered our own AXFR module for getting a sort of file from the other site over. I mean, if really people want to do it with 1.OVZ, go to bind, you know, use that. And, okay, I thought I was being interrupted. And for all this, we started to introduce a small configuration file, and so it makes it easier for the user. And NSD, the next step, still in the 2.0, was a slightly more dynamic behavior. You could do sonar transfer into the server or out to the server. We supported tsig, and we also delivered some small control program, so less Python user interface, and it actually some more complexity in the internal and internally and for the user. User could get away with slightly less clue, and because some things were done for them. And but still, big memory hog, and it will always be that way. NSD 3, that was actually the current one is being running now, and it has a lot of extra stuff to make life easier for the user. And so we now listen to notifies. We use actually the timers in the SOA record for doing the slaving, and we also do full DNSSEC in this one. MSEC3 cut into it, and there's more DNS meta support. The dname is in it, and the control program has been expanded. And that's why the internal complexity grew. You get special for getting the XFR stuff in. And so now it's actually 3 modules doing IPC and. But still, we are still on the same server speed and no internal database. What really did change is that it's even easier for users to use it. So less clue required there. And apart from doing the configuration file, because that grew, of course. So there's some ideas we have about NSD4. At first, we have a logo. And so I can make t-shirts out of it. And the other thing is that lots of saunas. And that's one of the goals. We should do at least a couple of 100K saunas at the same time. And that's what the question we get and a lot, and which is so special ISPs want to use it as well, not just the CCTLDs. And so you see, but so. So we think about doing salt configuration templates, because special ISP is more or less the same, only the name changes and or whatever. There are a couple of easy ways to get around, so you can automatically generate the sort of file much easier and sort of configuration. What we're also going to do is again a change of the internal database, and this has two aspects around. We are actually able to speed up the server by changing the data model from what we're doing now. And we're also thinking about more pre-processing, so we can even do getting faster again. And one of the things to do is to store the MSX3 hashes, and there are a lot of other tricks we're thinking about. And what of course will happen is that the internal complexity will grow enormously, and but the complexity moves to the compiler subsystem. So not to the server itself. We try to keep that as ignorant as possible, because ignorant is bliss. NSD control will be, instead of throwing signals to the various parts, actually have a real control port, so you can much better control what is going on. And it will actually hide the complexity way more than... So the users can be, again, clueless. We will also try to allow for more dynamic behavior, reconfiguration on the fly, and reloading some, and maybe some dynamic updates, but we only want to do that if we can get away with it. It really makes things more complicated than you want. What we also want to do is to improve the TCP support. You know, with all those bigger and bigger packages, you're much easier to go to TCP than anything else. And there are some ideas to allow a lot of TCP streams. But what we actually don't want is that all these added features hamper the original target audience, the root servers, and the CCTODs, because that is... That is still the point where we're working at. So we rather lose some features or say no to people. We will actually say no to some of the features and requests, because it will slow it down. Whenever this will become non-vaporware, well, at the end of this year, we hope to have the first version done. But we're still open for suggestions. We're still kind of playing with it. And I'm around here all week, so if people want to have some specific stuff, talk to me, and I'll compile the list, and then we're going to say no. We have done some testing, and so for real marketing slides, here we go. The new memory layout we actually put in NSD 2.7, and we tested that with three scenarios. I mean, something like a root environment, one zone, 500 delegation. That's it, boys and girls. And then medium-sized TLD, one zone, 1M delegation, and an ISP type of workload, you know, 100K saunas, 10 delegations per sauna, standard stuff. And the test setup, well, here are the numbers of the test setup, but basically we did about 1 million queries randomized, and so it's roughly 100,000 queries per second will come to 64 megabit query stream. So if you see that happening, you know how many queries you do. Anyway, the assumptions are all the domains are called more or less the same. We don't look at next domain. We also don't do DNFSEC with those tests. So, but then doesn't really matter that much for the server. It doesn't know about it. And so here is what we can do for the root server. And do I have a point? I have a pointer. The red one is our standard echo test. Basically, it shows you you go up to the stack, and the only thing we do is echo the packets back. And you don't do any processing, so it gives you an idea the maximum speed you can get stuff into in and out your machine, which is 10,000, something like that. Okay, then we have here the first version of NSD4, so with the new memory. And this is NSD3, and this is a version of Bind. And you see the difference comes for themselves. So you see that we actually win some speed there, and roughly about 30%. The same with if you lots of songs and... the big song. Sorry, we're TLD now. And you get about the same figures, and but so you can easily do that. I mean, what did you say? There's one M's records, but it's about 50 queries a second. You get there, and then we have the being an ISP, lots of zoners and. We are holding it pretty good there. And these are these weird bumps, which we don't... We have an explanation for it, but it's so complicated that you don't want to know. But it has to deal with how...
We have time.
Yeah.
But we still don't
want to
know.
You still don't want to know. It's very... Right. And I forgot half of it. It's really kind of complicated. But what you see here is that... This looks promising still for holding up. So we actually surpass our original calls, and we can do all these things. More marketing slides. This is makes it real. So this is way more dramatic. The 95% returns. I mean, this is broom broom. The bind NSD. NSD and the Echo Demon. So this is, you see, in average, we actually bump up 30% using these points. And now, as I said, I'll be around to talk and note a little line in the bottom. I'll take checks. anyway, any questions?
Also, quite a cool presentation, I must say.
Hi, Mauricio from .cl. Do you have any plans to introduce more logging in your software?
Well, the first one didn't have any logging at all. And the reason for that is, you know, you've got TCP dump, do it that way. I mean, although it doesn't tell you a lot about what's going on inside the server. And there are some plans to do some improving in locking, but locking slows down the server. So you're very reluctant to introduce locking for standard use. We do have an awful lot of debugging and other flags, but you don't want to run it continuously. If you have specific needs for doing locking, I mean, let us know what exactly it is, and we might be able to introduce, to do something there. But we actually do some locking now, but it's very little, and you have to do a lot of hand-waving to get it out. But we might do something. Especially since we now have the control channel, it is probably easy to switch it on and off in doing real runs. So you can have a quick lock, see things are okay. Okay, switch it off again because you want to get maximum speed. So.
Matt Pouncett from Aphilius. One of the things we find with 3 is that it's also very I/O hungry. That You know, when you're, if you're, we've got a couple of our zones that are updating, you know, 6,000 records per minute, things like that. And it, you have to do the IXFR, write that to disk, recompile the database, then reload the entire zone off disk into memory. And if you get a, and if you have a few of those running on a machine because you've multiple zones, then it it really bogs down the I/O on the machine. Are there any plans to change how that architecture works?
Yes, there are plans for changing that, and I was talking about the compilation. The things will be compiled. There will be multiple processes running and doing this stuff on the fly, and then when they're over, they fork off to the new database, and so it can be done in parallel. And if it's really becoming a problem now, I mean, one of the suggestions is, I mean, do the compilation on a different machine, but that has more work, of course.
Mehmet, Elroot and NSD user as well. The logging question also, is it? Do you have any plans for some kind of statistical tool deployment that can actually, you know, show us what's like the query load on the server, etc.?
We haven't thought that much about logging yet, but whether we're very careful not to try to keep the server as stupid as possible, and because that helps. And so, as I said, if you really some specific things you really want to be locked, and if we can squeeze it in, we probably will. So, make your wishes known early.
Were these tests done on IPv4 only?
I actually don't know. About the caves and 2 meters.
Is there any reason why no DNSSEC enabled tests? No, you mentioned that those tests weren't done with any kind of DNSSEC queries, if I'm not mistaken.
No, we're not, we're done without DNSSEC, no signs on or whatever. And
okay.
So it was just a very quick run to see whether it was indeed an improvement of the original. And
I personally think that it would be a good idea to include in future tests with you guys, and as well as with Bind 10 and, you know, ISC to, you know, zones that are signed, because the actual world is right now signed. So
this is just
just a 2 cent.
This is not meant to be a serious test or whatever. And this morning I actually heard that what they did is another experiment to do more compilation, and doing that on the flight, having more compiled answers, gives you another 30%, but it really eats memory. It's probably not something you really want, because then, I mean, the memory chips providers will be very happy.
Hi, Paul Vados, Excellence. A lot of setups actually use hidden primaries for providing DNSSEC to another server to then sign it later on and then push it forward. So one of the things that's really missing in NSD for that deployment, where you have a hidden name server going towards the signer, going towards public name servers, is the somewhat more automatic NSD patching and the IXFR from differences. So that's really a big miss. And the other thing is, please use Git instead of SVN.
I didn't cut all of that, but the way IXFRs are done, and the patch will be gone. It won't be there anymore, and so it will be. It won't. That's why it's called 4. It won't look like internally at all at NSD3, and some of the annoying way NSD3 works won't be there, because it's completely different. And that's especially because people complain about, why are you doing, you know, I think you were one of the complainers always.
There you go.
And what probably will happen is, since not all of these things are needed for the root servers is that we probably will have version 3 have a longer life than what we normally do, which is basically 1 year after the major version comes out, the rest is killed. But since this is so completely different and not all of our users are actually in need of this, we might have a longer support for version 3.
Hello, Dmitry Kovmanyuk here, Hostmaster Ukrainian Registry. Well, we're also user of NSD and we are quite happy. I have a very simple request. After that, we'll start donating to you guys. It used to be that the timestamps and log were in Unix UTC format. I realized everybody wears the clocks that show that. It'll be very nice, though, to have an option to log in UTC, you know, ISO time format, like a year, months, you know, stuff like that. Not the Unix C time format. So that's the only thing I would say. And thank you for the presentation.
I didn't got everything of that, but you mean timestamps, which in the log, yeah.
I meant second since 1st of January 1970.
One of the reasons of doing that is, again, you know, if you don't have to confer to human readable stuff, then it saves cycles. But it's already now an option to do it in real time in human readable things. But it's, if you really want to squeeze everything out of a machine, you want to be it as, you know, stupid as possible.
I must understand. I must say I don't understand that request, because that's not a time analysis. Is not time critical, so you write your routine to translate it. I don't understand that. If you want to squeeze horsepower out of a name server, you take all the you trim all the fat, as they say in this country.
Yeah, I mean, so give a. I don't know what the source code. Trim all the fat, part of the game, and I don't know what the current line count is of NSD, but anybody can find out. But I remember NSD 1.0 when it came out. It was only 8,000 lines of code, that's it, compared to the 300,000 of somebody else. But
all right. No more questions? Thank you very much. Very, very much, yeah.
Thank you.
We most certainly must do this again. Okay, as usual, we have closing arguments, so to say. And as usual, Jay Daly will do it. And because this time it's a joint thing with OARC, Wayne and Jay will do it together. Sorry, but I wasn't really aware of the name.
I'd just like to do a call. My name is Wolfgang Nagler. I work for the RIPE-NCC, and AFNIC had a presentation yesterday here about their DNSSEC failure, and we also have to admit that we had a failure in E164 ARPA, which is the enum domain. And in light of that, we decided that we want to put forward an approach in terms of how we can verify DNSSEC before we are publishing bogus data. And so what I'm basically calling for here is interested DNS operators to join me in after we closed here to have a brief discussion of what requirements those DNS operators would have for such a verification mechanism. So anybody willing to chime in there, just stay here after we have closed.
Well, first of all, I want to thank everybody who presented and everybody who showed up. It's been a really interesting couple days. A couple things we've observed. First of all, this is by far the best attended OARC meeting we've had in a very, very long time, so thank you. We're up about, probably almost 50% from where we usually are, so that's great. Interesting bunch of topics, so I thought that was great. In particular, I want to thank the guys from CZNIC for showing up with the GPU presentation yesterday. And to echo the comment of why not? I think that's great. I think we should, as a community, I think we should need to do more of that kind of stuff. You know, if you look at things like the problem that that the guys in Chile are having with the weird patterns in DNS they're seeing, I think there's an opportunity there for, you know, somebody, hopefully us, to take a look at that data and start, you know, playing MythBusters. And, you know, let's take a few ideas of what it might be, and let's see if we can prove or disprove it. You know, we have a wealth of information through not just the individual registries, but as a whole. I think that's an interesting opportunity, and something we're going to pursue. I think that's a, you know, it doesn't necessarily have a particular goal, but it could produce some really interesting research, and more importantly, maybe actually find the answer to some of these questions. Yeah, so that's it for me. If anybody has any questions about OARC, people who don't know us, I am around. I'd be happy to answer any questions, either here or offline. I hope to see more of you in the future. And with that, I'll let Jay close it off. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. For those of you who want to laugh, very shortly we will be starting the DNS Sec for Beginners session in another room, and I will be playing Dr. Evil again. So, as Wayne said, this has been a great meeting. We've got, you know, 100 people in the room or something like that, and I think we've had a very productive session. For some years now, the focus really through OARC has been on measurement and analysis, and through the CCTLD community has been on greater collaboration. And I think that this meeting has enhanced both of those quite nicely. From the CCTLD perspective, certainly, the measurement and analysis helps with things like our capacity planning, server placement strategies, service planning, those sorts of things. And I think huge progress has been made. At the same time, though, there are two meta benefits or larger benefits which I think are important for us to note. One of which is this cross-industry collaboration, so that we're no longer just being CCTLDs or just being security companies or just DNS experts or whatever. We're working together towards some greater common cause. And the other one, possibly more importantly, is bringing a degree of scientific method to DNS and then onto the technical community. For me, the answer to the question why I tried to implement signing on GPUs was to test the hypothesis. You know, we're never going to know whether it works or doesn't work until somebody writes some code to test it. We can eliminate it as a hypothesis, or we can learn something from it. And we have both at the same time a remarkable wealth of experience in the room and knowledge, but that can also be our undoing at times, because there are people here who can work out the implication of something technical in about a quarter of a second. And yet, sometimes, unless we actually build something, run it and test it, we'll never know whether those things work. And so what I see coming from these meetings, what I think is going to continue coming from these meetings and these community, is that scientific approach where we develop our hypotheses, we build things, we test them, and we act rationally, and we get away from our judgmental side of things at just deciding one technology is better than another. And I think by doing this in a more structured way, we're learning things much better. We're developing, and we're going to make much better verifiable progress. So thank you all for coming. It's been fantastic. I think we will be talking again about whether we can do this again, because it's been such a good meeting for all of us. There are now two sessions to follow off to if you want to. All right. There's the law enforcement session, which has been going all day, where Eberhard will be leading off to that. And there is the DNSSEC for beginners, which I'm sure most of you know, but if you want to come along for a laugh and throw things at Dr. Evil, I shall be heading off to. Thank you all for coming.
Okay, the law enforcement section is in Elizabethan A to C, which is just around the corner.
All right, thank you very much, everybody, for coming.